Hello, Anatomy movie fans. This intro is a little bit different for one of two reasons. We will be doing new intros in the future, but I also want to share a mini State of the Union, if you will. For those of you who've been watching and listening from the very beginning, first off, thank you so much. And at this point, you know that we've done over 200 movie reviews. And with each one of them, we try to give insightful opinions, great facts that kind of engages not only us, but also you, the viewer. And as we strive for perfection here at Anatomy of a Movie, we kind of had our own gathering of the minds, if you will, all the producers, all the hosts, and what we really took was your comments over the past years and thought about how we can make this show better. And so to begin with, one of the reasons why I'm doing this is because we want to tell you that now we're trying to revamp Anatomy of a Movie. And hopefully you guys can see the differences. The core of the show remains the same, as I said. Insightful opinions and a lot of fact-based stuff. But what we will be bringing to the table is a lot more visuals. But don't worry, audio fans, if you listen on the podcast side of it, there will be also a link for you guys to download the pictures so that way you don't feel lost and feel like only the video portion of the audience is getting something out of this. Also, we're going to include our rundowns, which, because we do so much research on every single one of these shows, we don't always get to talk about it. And so that's a nice way for you guys to see what it is that we're actually talking about, what interests us, and, you know, check out and dig deeper into some of the things that we enjoyed. And the other aspect is, you know, the great thing that I thought about for me that I want to impart on the show a little bit more is, regardless of whether or not we like a movie, there's always the filmmaking process that remains the same. A lot of times I'll buy a DVD to a movie that I've never seen, and I don't even necessarily want to see it, but I know it has such a great behind-the-scenes commentary, and I'll watch that first. For that very reason is that it's so engaging, and I learn so much. And so we want to really bring that passion to you guys and highlight that process, as well as give our opinions. You know, the format still overall remains the same. We're going to talk about the story elements, the writing, the directing, the editing, box office and reception, everything in between. But now, hopefully, times 10. So one of the things that we would like to ask you guys have been commenting, which has been great. If you haven't left the review for quite a bit, especially on iTunes, please do so. Update it so that way we can have fresh feedback on this new format in particular, and hopefully you guys enjoy it. So without further ado, we're going to do Hail Caesar coming up.
Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
I'm opening. We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. All hail Caesar, the 2016 Joel and Ethan Coen brothers movie. It's billed as a comedy. It's a day in the life of a 1950s fixer. It's their 18th movie that they've done together. And sixth movie that they've directed specifically together. It had a budget of $22 million. And we have today Dimitri Panos, of course, MoviePass, VP of Exhibitor Relations and formerly of Technicolor and Lionsgate, Marissa Serafini, Senior Content Producer of AfterBuzz TV, and of course, Popcorn Talk and Visual Design Expert. In the booth, we have writer, director, and geek, Zach Wilson.
Hey,
how's it going, everybody?
That's right. And I'm your host, Phil Svitek, CEO of AfterBuzz TV Networks and Popcorn Talk, and a feature film editor. So I bring that side of it to the table. As we always do, let's start with overall impressions. Dimitri, hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar.
Hail us with your thoughts.
Well, you know, going into this movie, looking at the trailers, the marketing, everything that was done, it's a Coen Brothers movie. You know, I went into this film thinking, wow, this movie was, like, tailor-made. It's going to be a farce. It's going to be an homage to that period of filmmaking, which was around the mid-50s, going into the 60s. And it's the Coen brothers. Great cast of characters. And I went and saw the movie, and when I came out, I felt as if I were a little bit bamboozled by the marketing. You know, it was, while there were elements of comedy and farce and good, really good comedy at times, I just felt that they sort of kind of lied in hiding the fact that this movie was very scattershot.
And Forbes came out with a great article that we'll definitely talk about the promotion at length when we get to that portion.
Yeah, and I think for me anyways, it really ended up, I had hoped to love this movie, and I walked away wishing that I had liked it more. It didn't make me angry. Very important to note, it didn't make me angry, and it indeed, you know, had some good stories to it, and as only the Coen brothers did, they pay their homages to film history and the types of, the various variety types of films that were coming out in that time period. They did a great job at that, and some of the performances were great, but again, it was a little bit scattershot, and mm-hmm. some of the themes just didn't tie up as well as I had hoped.
All right, Marissa?
I enjoyed this film. I liked the vignette storytelling that they had in the way that they showed every scene with each different character. I liked the dynamics of the characters that were introduced to the audience because there was really not one character I severely disliked. Because they were in a vignette type of story, I wanted to see, as a viewer, I wanted to see more of these characters. And every once in a while we kept cutting back to them, but I wanted to just hang out with them a little bit more because they were so fun and they had fun personalities. Overall, you know, the Coen brothers, they're kind of, for me personally, hit or miss, but I did enjoy this one. It was fun. It kept my attention the whole time. And I did like the look.
So. Perfect. And of course, Zach.
You know, I wanted to love this movie. Everything about it was leading it to be a great Coen Brothers adventure, and I love the Coen Brothers. For me, there's a lot of great moments, but overall the story just fell... It was wanting at the end of the day. It didn't have the tight structure that I wanted it to have, that really I needed to truly love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, you know, there's two types. And by the way, let me preface, I'm not like a Coen Brothers diehard person. It's not that I don't like them. I just haven't seen all of their movies, so just know that going into them. But that doesn't mean I don't like them. I like No Country for Old Men. I like Burn After Reading. This, I thought, would be more like Burn After Reading and had certain elements of that, but right. never really got going. As we mentioned, the marketing made it confusing at times. And overall, you know, I think I would compare it to, ironically, Grease Live at this point in time, only because a lot of critics of that are saying that the musicals themselves were fantastic, but in lieu of the story, didn't hit as much. And I think each, you know, these vignettes, these moments stand out. And in an age of YouTube, I think in time, those can actually get more views than the entire movie itself.
Right.
And I think that's just kind of where we're at with it.
I don't know. I agree with Zach, too, that, I don't know, and again, I just take it back to marketing. I felt that this was going to be, like, had they marketed it as a day-in-the-life tale of this Eddie Mannix character and the stuff that he had to deal with, I would have been better prepped where I felt that this was going to be a, like, this, it was going to focus on this. And I just felt that there was a lot crammed into this movie that they just couldn't get a handle. It was almost like they bit off a little bit more than they can chew. And I sort of felt that way as an audience member. So mm-hmm. I loved some, didn't like some. It was almost like an anthology movie in a sense. You know? It was.
So here's an interesting question for all of you guys. What storyline did you like the most? And which storyline would you have cut out?
I would have cut out Deanna's whole story about her now having a child, an unexpected child, and her running away with
the person,
quote unquote, because it was fun. Deanna, the way that they set up her character is like she's very in the spotlight. Everyone knows her. If there's a relationship, and now that there's a pregnancy, who's the father? So I understand the scandal to what, but it didn't really wrap the storyline. Didn't wrap up in a oh, that's how it ended. And for an audience, you're like, okay, I guess that can happen, sure. And it felt like it was just quickly wrapped up.
See, I really liked her storyline, or I liked a bunch of her storyline. I thought her, like, the gag of her adopting her own child was one of the funniest, most Hollywood things I'd ever heard. And, but I agree. I was not sold on how it resolved, because it seemed to come just out of left field.
Hey, Zach, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Because I just got a notice. I actually have to go and fix something.
Oh, do you?
I do. And I have to Eddie Mannix something. Phil, do you have any petty cash on you? I need like
hundreds or twenties.
Well, if you could just do it all hundreds, about 100,000 of those hundreds would be fantastic.
There you go, Dimitri.
Yep.
Keep it safe.
Yep. Here we go.
Hopefully, we're not utilizing a briefcase like they were.
Do you need the key? I have the key.
If I drop this, I sink to the ocean as well.
All right, so while Dimitri goes off and fixes it, Marissa, Zach, and I are left. We'll continue this show, and then when Dimitri fixes whatever he's got, he'll come back.
I
agree with you. I mean, I agree with you, Zach, that it was one of the most Hollywood things in terms of her adopting her own baby. The problem for me was that she herself wasn't as funny as the other characters. You know, she played it very straight in that way. I can't remember Scarlett doing comedy, unless I'm completely wrong, and you know, that might be part of the problem. I don't know, and I just know she was...
The Island.
Okay.
You call The Island.
Different. I think that's a mixing of genres.
Scoop. I think Scarlett Johansson, she plays a lot of serious roles that have comedic moments. I wouldn't peg her as a comedian actress, for sure. There's Scoop. She's been in a lot of romantic kind of drama, comedy, dramedies in a way. But for her character, Deanna was supposed to be a very straight-laced, posh type of actress, and you wouldn't think a scandalous type of backstory to her to give her character some, you know, comedic elements to this film. I don't think I as a viewer didn't believe that this story could happen.
Okay. I believe that the story could have happened, but it's just so ridiculous. I mean, it's one of those things where the more ridiculous it is, the more believable. The more it's seemingly unbelievable, the more grounded in reality it actually can be.
I mean, that's the Coen brothers' real specialty at that point, is making the absurd feel reasonable.
Yeah.
Indeed. But I do want to start with Eddie Mannix, because he's the glue that holds all of this together. And without him, like, you know, Zach, you're a writer, so I want to, you know, ask you, but Marissa, feel free to chime in too. Would this movie have worked without Eddie Mannix's character holding it together?
No. You needed somebody to be the glue of this, because especially with the whole vignette situation, like, unless you're going to go true 100% like full throttle vignettes where everything that you're doing is shorts, like Paris Je T'aime, if my horrible French accent conveyed the title of that movie, that's just separate shorts around a theme. And if you're not going to do that, you do need a central character to be your guide into this world.
I agree with that, Zach. You do need the person who's the most grounded, the most centered, and also is the most consistent throughout the whole film, compared to such an ensemble cast that this film was, that everyone was very quirky, neurotic, or paranoid, or something. There was some element that made these characters just, in a way, I don't want to say crazy, but very eccentric. And it was actually good to have that one person that was the calm, sane one throughout all the chaos that was going on, that the audience can still relate to and understand what the heck is happening.
I agree with you, you know, and it's ironic in the sense, obviously by design, that Hail Caesar is about the search for, you know, religion and spirituality. And then, Zach, you had a question of, is Mannix a Jesus metaphor with him bearing the sin for the entire industry? And so I wanted to kind of, you know, have you expand on that, if you will.
I mean, it that's more or less sums it up, but, like, I wasn't sure by the end of it. They're very clearly using the Jesus movie as, like, a focal point of the church that we all go to every week is movies and television now. That's the altar that we worship at, for better or worse. That's where we spend our time. In the movie, he tries to use the movies to tell a religious story, which in theory is something he's trying to do good. He's trying to play right by religion. But he deals with so much terrible, so many terrible people around him. His worst vice is that he lies to his wife about a cigarette. He's almost saintly in that way, even though he's dealing with covering up having babies out of wedlock or paying off bribes, all this kind of stuff.
But is it interesting that so he's the fixer in this world, but then, you know, as you mentioned, the wife, she asked him to fix and call the coach, and he's going to do that, and kind of like most of us in the entertainment industry, we put all personal things aside, even, you know, to, for us, it could be the point of eating, where that gets by the wayside. Mm-hmm. But in his world, that managed to fix itself, and so it did present to me, at least, I could be reading way too much into it, this thing of, you know what, just let things be, and they'll sometimes work out.
I agree with that. Also, for Zach, to more to your point as well, that I liked how he was a religious man. He had strong faith and strong morals and values. But I liked how they bookended this movie, showing the audience that even though he is the most grounded man, he still is showing the audience he has flaws and vices, and he has internal struggles that we're like, okay, he's not the perfect man either, but he's the character who has to be perfect for everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which made him real and believable.
He was a believable character, if nothing else. He felt very real world. Like, you could have met that guy if you had been walking through the studio a lot in the 50s.
Absolutely.
I agree. And what did you guys think of his internal struggle, right? Because he's dealing with all these different things at the studio, but then he's got the question of, okay, do I go with Lockheed or do I just go with what I know, which is the movie industry? And that was kind of a crux of all of this, and it was the additional ticking time bomb, certainly for him in all of this. So I wanted to get, you know, your guys' take on that as a device.
I think it's great because it helped as a time bomb. It helped still keep the story moving forward. And granted, it is like told in vignette kind of storytelling. So it allowed the audience to realize, oh, he has to get this done. He has to make a decision. He doesn't have a lot of time to think about it and contemplate it. He just keeps moving forward. And in a sense, this added time pressure to him just... again, he's like, that's the way he approaches things. Like, he has to get it done, so he just makes hasty decisions, but there's still logic to it.
Is that what the quality that Lockheed was looking for? Because one of my questions was, and I'd hate to feel stupid about it, but, you know, Lockheed at the time, you know, big corporation, now it's Lockheed Martin. Their famous plane is the Blackbird, and I love planes, so, like, I used to geek out on this stuff. But I just didn't quite know. To me, it seemed like a MacGuffin in that sense. Like, I didn't necessarily know what he brought to Lockheed. Was it literally just his ability to fix anything and everything? You know? Because very different industries.
Well, I think at this point in time, no one really saw the movie industry as so separated the way we see it today, where entertainment is its own industry that requires its own expertise and a simple finesse. It was just a business, and he had run a good business up until that point. So without knowing the details of entertainment, of course it'll translate to aircraft and science and engineering.
Yeah, and then you see all these planes going down.
Yeah, I think it's more so also just character development for him. It shows that he's so good at his job that two places really want and need him for his decision-making, and I think that just adds that... that shows his internal struggle working with the people that he knows, and he knows their personalities. He knows how to resolve problems with the people he works with every day compared to just giving advice to someone else, which is, you know, lacking.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, and it was interesting because obviously they made him a 10-year commitment. He wouldn't have to ever work a day in his life after that and so on and so forth. And so, you know, he just went with, you know, it's the constant thing, like, do you sell out or do you go with what you believe is right? All right. Well, why don't we kind of talk about the Tilda Swinton character? Because I thought, to me, they were funny, the twins.
I love
the competition.
Yeah, I loved having rival gossip columnists, especially played by the same actress. I think it was fantastic because there was a quick line where they set up, oh, my sister, and I didn't realize that they were twins until we saw her the second time. I'm like, oh, I get what's happening now. So, again, just two people pitting against each other for the same type of information. It really shows the industry and how people and the means of how people go about to try to get scoops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. Zach, what did you think of this storyline?
I mean, it was fun. It was pure, just like there was a pure silliness to it between the two of, like, and the I thought Tilda Swinton and Josh Brolin played off of each other very nicely. And like it was, we were having trouble telling them apart.
Yeah,
because one of them would be in yellow, and then I think who was dressed with yellow trim reversed when they came back to confront Howie.
I just always thought of them. One had a viewership of the 18 million,
yeah,
and one had a viewership of the 20 million. So
I mean, that's a sibling rivalry right there.
Yeah,
it was.
But that was my, you know, that was my differentiation. What I liked about it, to piggyback off what you're saying, Zach. They matched each other's freneticness. Like, Mannix, he's always on the move, and as calm as he may be, which I give him a lot of credit for in this crazy world, because you could see someone just being totally, I can't handle this. But he has that fast-paced talking, and so does, so does each of the twins. They match each other nicely, whereas the other people, because they're trying to figure themselves out or whatever the case may be, obviously they're in different situations, it doesn't have that energy like these guys had, which made it, to me, fun. So I like that a lot. And, I mean, ultimately they were used, I thought, nicely as an exposition device into these various things because, it gave us that break of it.
Yeah, and the way that I also remember the differentiation is also color, because one was in yellow and another one was in orange. So, like, bright colors, bright cherry colors, and one was always 5 minutes ahead of the other one. So, and, like, that's why
she was the future.
Yeah, she was the future. She was with the one with the higher viewers, because someone was always 5 minutes ahead of the other one.
So who was it, again, because it just went by me so fast, but who was it at the end that he was particularly talking to? Was it Thora or Thalisa?
I can't Thessaly. Even...
Thessaly.
I honestly have no idea.
That's what I'm saying.
I couldn't tell you either.
And that's the... You know what I love? It's the fun part that it doesn't matter.
Thora was the first person we met.
Yes.
And
yes.
Thessaly was the second one. So I want to say we went to Thora.
Yeah.
Because then he gave the scoop to Thessaly by mistake.
Yeah, that was it.
But, yeah, now I'm trying to remember exactly who. Either way.
But
one outsmarted the other in the end, too.
Yeah.
So.
If you're listening or watching, leave a comment. And be honest, I'd like to know if you knew who he was talking to at the end of the final negotiations, because I couldn't tell one way or the other. Also, speaking of that, the comment, the exclusive, I thought it was such a Hollywood thing to utilize something like a piece of information that you know is going to be set up in that way of like, oh, I'm giving you exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And just totally not genuine.
No. And again, maybe that's just the sad reality that is Hollywood and what people will do for a story.
Absolutely. So let's talk about let's get into a little bit of the Hail Caesar aspect of this, right? It as a movie, and there's, you know, we'll obviously make full Hollywood comparisons to the 1950s a little bit later, but just as that kind of, you know, that's their pinnacle movie, and the picture that we do have a picture of the Hail Caesar poster, which is actually for this movie. However, I picked it because you could imagine that this would be the type of poster that would come out
in the 50s.
In the 50s for this particular movie. And I guess, you know, I was going to ask you guys this a little bit later, but, you know, might be a fun question now. Out of these movies presented in the story, which of them would you have actually gone to see if you were living in the 1950s?
Well, I mean, if it's me just, like, in the 50s, I gotta say
Marvel doesn't exist at this point in time.
I'm aware. But I would probably say Howie's Western. As a Jew, the story of Jesus doesn't have a lot of appeal to me. The strange sailor musical dance number.
You didn't like the gay sailors?
I mean, it was funny. It's not the first. I would pick a Western over it.
Fair enough.
And then the other one was, what, mermaids?
Yeah, mermaids.
Just didn't have the appeal that I would normally go for.
See, I would choose the sailor musical because musicals I'm a big fan of, and dancing. I always appreciate talented people, and I'm a big fan of Gene Kelly. And not to jump ahead, but Channing Tatum's character, it really reminded me of Gene Kelly's style. I liked it. It was entertaining. I wanted to see more numbers.
Yeah, it certainly was a good number. I'm with Zach, actually. I would have seen the Western. I think that stuff is fun. I'm a big fan of Westerns, although most of them in the 50s were kind of musical Westerns, which I'm not the biggest fan of. I'm more a spaghetti Western kind of guy. I would have seen that one. But we'll certainly, like, George Clooney, so him as Caesar and all, he's just so brilliant, and one of the things that they obviously wanted to go with him is just take him to the edge of silliness, and then as soon as they got him there, be able to still show not only the audience that's watching, but also kind of in the movie world, show that he is this big star, deserving of, you know, the pinnacle movie. The problem of it, I like those aspects of it, but ultimately as a storyline, it didn't go the full route. He was just, to me, as a device, and I think those portions where he didn't really act, and again, this is the tough part, but talking about a movie,
I'm starting to lose you. And I saw it.
I like movies within movies, though.
Him as Bard didn't really do too much in the actual movie. And I kind of knew that going into it, but I, in hindsight, I would have preferred him to do a little bit more.
I mean, I can definitely see why you bring that up. I think for George Clooney playing Baird, this is, again, his fourth collaboration with the Coen brothers. He's known... Every time he's in a Coen Brothers film, his character is known for not being the smartest or sharpest tool in the toolbox. And I think this was just another one where he's not the smartest guy. Granted, his character is the top-billed actor, but he's not the smartest, again, the smartest person around. And I like the fact that they had to keep him hostage in a house, literally at the edge of a cliff, where he physically had nowhere to go. So he was... literally trapped in a location. As for you saying not doing anything, he really didn't, because I think it was everyone else who had to tell the audience what was happening, because he was trying to figure it out as well. Mm-hmm. Therefore, didn't really do a lot, because he's just trying to figure out the exposition of the story.
Yeah. Zach, how did you feel about him?
I mean, he was fun. He was a little more than a plot device. Mm-hmm. I think once the movie got started, but his sort of just the dumbness of how he just accepted, like, his kidnapper story, he took to Stockholm syndrome instantly. It was funny. I mean, you needed him there, I guess, for that part of the plot to develop. But we'll get it when we talk about the story more overall. His storyline, I thought, had issues, but he as a character was funny.
Well, so, you know, I mean, you can't necessarily talk about him without the communist, right? And so you interestingly pointed out that he's, you know, Stockholm Syndrome. But I wanted to, you know, one of the reasons why, for me, say he didn't do as much is because he got the communist slap silly out of him by Mannix right off the bat as soon as he tried to do anything with that knowledge. But in terms of the way the communist presented it, as absurd as it was, and I'm not a communist expert, I mean, you could see why Bard would have gone that route. I mean, it was making sense despite the random stuff and that was convoluted with.
I mean, it pointed out, I think, a lot of the problems in entertainment, especially today. I started to think, like, if the Coen brothers were trying to make, like, a complaint, like, hey, we're not getting enough as the authors of these movies. But it's the question of fairness. And I think regardless of who you are, there's a relatability to questioning what is fair. I feel cheated. Everyone's felt cheated at some point. So he connects to that, and he's just in with the communists. I think, Phil, you had mentioned it before the show, just the idea that the future could have been any number of things. It was a funny beat when they were just communists and nothing more insane.
Yeah, because this is more on the marketing side of it, when they have that note of we are the future, and give us $100,000, you're like, oh dear Lord, please don't let this be some psycho like future time travel weirdo. What is this? But the fact that they are the communists and that they believe that they do know the future is so funny to me. And I don't know, from the limited knowledge that I actually have of communism, it's one of those things that on paper sounds good, but it's more about complaining, where in practicality, no one really has a solution for how things actually could work. And I'm not saying capitalism is better by any means, but I think it's just a never-ending cycle of what could work versus what couldn't. And that, to me, they captured that. Whether or not they actually sided, the Coen brothers sided with any of these thoughts, it's just that absurdity where you can talk about this round and round and down to the point of this isn't about money, it's about economy. What?
And I think that was also, if you remember, this is, you know, kind of set in the 50s times. So the communism was on the rise in the Hollywood industry. So, yes, it does make sense that communism would be involved in this movie and working with each other. Also, it was fun to see Baird, you know, communicate with these guys, and he's actually having a fun time. But again, his character is not the brightest that, even at the end, not to jump ahead, where we see he's still left alone in the house and the communists left him. It shows that he's still not fully on board with them, literally. So it was fun for the interaction, but still not believable that he would go all full communist.
Yeah, and I did like how they laid in those kind of things that in hindsight make sense of whose house it was, right? It was Bert's house, very famous actor, so on and so forth. But I wanted to ask you guys this. What is the symbolism of the $100,000? Because we get that great note. They all talk about the money, and then, you know, it's got to go to the cause. And then it just sinks without a trace. And from my perspective, Bert wasn't really thrown by it. He wasn't really upset by it. Am I reading too much into it in any way?
I don't think he was really upset, because he's going to a happier place for him. And I just kept thinking, all right, how is Eddie Mannix going to figure out with the studio where did the $100,000 go? So that was just like another problem that he would also have to fix. Like, okay, now there's missing money. What do we do? But for the money,
that never really came back.
No, it didn't. And I I wanted that as well, because we see Mannix fix all these problems. Now he has to fix one more with actual studio money. Where did it go?
I mean, I guess there was just less tracking of petty cash back in the day. Like, we don't know what Dimitri did with everything in that safe. But, like, we'll be asking him for receipts later. Maybe it just wasn't tracked as heavily. Like, he had more discretion as a studio head. If it had any symbolism, I would say, I guess, the futility of everything that they're doing as communists. Like, it's ultimately going to fail. And so is everything that everyone else is sort of doing at this point. Like, it's all just going to be dropped in the ocean. We're going to remember these movies in only the most vague of ways.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that.
So it's sort of the futility of everything that we do in life, which is sort of, again, a Coen Brothers theme.
Yeah, no, I actually like that a lot, because, you know, we all think we lead very meaningful lives, and then, like, I mean, it takes so much to get to the pinnacle of anything, but even that, like, you know, who remembers as much as, let's say, On the Waterfront won, you know, an Oscar for being a great movie, and we can talk about it and we know about it. Does the public know about it?
Probably not.
No. So, yeah, I definitely like that. Yeah, and, you know, I mean, the communists, it was just a funny ploy that I really enjoyed. Any one of the communists in particular that stood out to you? Because there were so many there, and they were all wonderful.
Not so much, because I saw them as a collective whole, because we never saw the communists by themselves.
That's communist thinking right there, by the way.
Maybe I was part of that group and you didn't know it. We never saw the communists by themselves. So, and I think we just heard their voices all together expressing one opinion. So there was not really one standalone for me.
There was only the one guy, I'm trying to remember the actor's name because I recognized him. He's a comedian who was just, like, yelling over things occasionally, like a little upset. He was a little bigger.
Mm-hmm.
He was always standing behind Baird.
I know who you're thinking.
Yeah, you know who I'm talking about, but I cannot for the life of me remember his name.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to look up a picture that just had all of them in a room and with their character names and so on. And that's what I love, you know, I love about this movie is the fact that a lot of this can kind of wash over you. You know, in particular, you don't necessarily even need to listen to all of the dialogue. You just get the essence of what's going on, and that's enough.
I will say, whichever one of you guys included this picture throwing up on the screen now, yes.
Always well done. Leave a note.
Well played.
Why? Because it's an Arrested Development callback?
Yeah, it's just a great gag.
So for those of you on audio, feel free to download the pictures, but this one is specifically of the letter, and it's a meme that says, always leave a note. You know, I mean, what I liked about the future and the communists was that this is where, I mean, it's the crux of kind of what's going on, right? It finally moves things forward without it really being a vignette. And I liked, and this is why I think we were talking a little bit earlier, why perhaps Scarlett Johansson's story kind of falls a bit flat, because everyone else gets sucked into this whirlwind of the communists. Certainly the twins and Hobie. Right, so as funny as Hobie's earlier moments are, he then now kind of takes that shift, and he really becomes the catalyst that drives it to, you know, the middle of certainly the movie, to make sure that then Eddie knows what's going on and so forth. So
we
let's
found
talk,
Dimitri.
We did find Dimitri. Where's the money?
I'm
back.
The
Clay, where are the receipts, Dimitri?
Oh, I got the receipts. You know, 100,000 buys a lot of Skittles, and it just saved our movie business.
Skittles?
only in this industry could that actually be factual.
Yeah.
Or absolutely. C-47s, that's actual factual.
That's true.
So, Dimitri, we just talked about the communists. In the future, and now we're kind of getting into Hobie and how him as a character, but also him as a catalyst to have propelled that story forward.
Okay. A catalyst. That's funny. Being he was a cowboy, a cattle.
Yes. The puns begin. What did you think of him as a character?
Yeah, I actually I liked him, and I liked the actor a lot as well. Again, going to that time period, the singing cowboy, moving in from. And then trying to transition him into more dramatic roles. I mean, Hollywood was doing this with their actors and just trying to build them up. And the way the actor played him, I thought he was – I really liked him a lot. This Alden Ehrenreich? Do we have a consensus of how to –
Alden.
Yeah. So Alden was – I really liked this kid a lot. I know that he was originally found by Steven Spielberg, but I enjoyed his aspect of the story. One of the funniest scenes in the movie is when he's sparring with Ralph Fiennes, Lorenz. And then having him be, in a sense, quote unquote, the hero. You know, he's a cowboy at heart and he wants to be the real life hero. I enjoyed that aspect of the story. Even though I didn't enjoy the communist aspect of the story so much,
what I liked about him, he had this innocence about him, and no matter what was, he just wanted to. Whereas Eddie is very knowledgeable of what needs to be fixed and things of that, he just naturally helps without consciously thinking about it. Yeah. He just where Eddie's torn between what's right and what's wrong. He just knows what's right and what he has to do to make it so.
Yeah, and he was a Roy Rogers kind of a character, you know? I mean, who, in a sense, too, wanted to, you know, help. He would just go out and help people, you know, Roy Rogers Foundation. But I liked Hobie Doyle as a character because of his innocence. And, you know, he's happy to be where he is. He loves this acting thing. Yeah, it was great. There's also a little side story, too, with going to this ball gala event and again being hooked up with another actress, which is something that Hollywood, I believe, probably still does today to some extent. But yeah, his innocence and I agree with you 100%. I thought he was great.
I want to dissect that "twere that it were so simple" scene, which I will admit, I can't pronounce.
Were that it were so simple.
Yeah. So it's one of those scenes, and I wish we kind of had Sarah to talk about this, but anytime a director has to get to repeat after me, which we call line reading, you know. It's just the ultimate, you're a bad actor at that point. He doesn't have, because number one, it could be that it's a bad director, or that it's such a bad actor that you're like, dear Lord, please just say it this way and let's move on.
I think it was a mix of both, because even from the director, he was giving ambiguous cues, like it was getting misinterpreted by Hobie, and understandably so, because Hobie has like one view of how he approaches movies. He's an action star. He doesn't know the dramatic, emotional depths of which this character is supposed to get to. Yeah. So I think it was just a mix of bad directing mixed with bad acting, fun.
And for me, I find it. I don't know. It's. I don't necessarily say it's bad acting. At least the way that Hail Caesar the movie presented it is, he was literally taken off of one movie and said, "You're going to do this movie." There was very little to no prep, and you know, this is, you're taking somebody out of their wheelhouse literally in the same day, and he has to do something else. Now, I know an actor should act. I get it. But when you're going from such a stark difference and you're really not given the prep to do this, it's how much can you blame it on bad acting? Like, they had to have known coming in that this guy might not have been suited for this role, but this is what the studio wants. How many times?
Well, they did have that conversation early on of like, "Do you got a better solution?" No. Okay.
So, you know, that sort of thing. You know, and again, back then, when actors had deals with studios, they would whore them out. Like, they would. you have a contract, you have to do so many pictures, and we're going to tell you the pictures. You're not picking and choosing. We're paying you. You're going to be in this movie, and oh, and then, you know, next month you're going to be in a mystery, and then you're going to be in a romantic comedy, then you're going to be in a swimming movie. And, yeah. You know, so I don't know how much I can blame him for bad acting. I just think that there were two people. Lawrence Lorenz may have been a great director, right? But when you're talking to two people who are on a different plane that just can't connect, who do you blame that on? Like, you know, other than it was great hilarity. I mean, that dialogue, again, was that was a scene that I was just laughing out loud. It was like it was almost like a Marx Brothers back and forth kind of dialogue.
Yeah, you know, Lawrence had trouble with it himself.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you read that, Marissa, somewhere.
The director, actually, I believe it was Ethan Coen, in interviews, when they talked about this scene, he himself loved the line. So it's not the easiest line. No. I think it was purposely set up that it was supposed to be simple.
Right.
Would that it would so be so simple.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. And so it's the fun, ironic the irony of it that makes it entertaining.
Yeah, and when you add the Western twang to it,
yeah,
as opposed to the stuffy, but you know, it was great.
Yeah,
was
and
great.
I think it was fun because
battle of dialect.
Seeing Hobie, who already has a thick accent, do something straightforward and straight laced type of simple line
right. That
you see his sincerity and his genuineness. He wants to hit it and be the good actor that he can be, but he's not.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, because I just thought about it. Do you, because I, you know, we have a decent knowledge of film history, of the movie industry. Do you think that helped our viewing overall with this movie and for an otherwise not knowledgeable audience of, let's say, the 1950s of film history? Would they get this stuff that we're talking about? Was that debilitating in any sort of way?
I think it would be, because the dialogue from character to character is very understandable back in that time, and it still is today. And I feel like we've all been part of productions that us personally, who's talking about this film, we know the elements that go into filmmaking, that goes into acting and editing and whatnot. We understand the actual verbatim and, you know, just the language of their interaction. So I don't think that hindered the film whatsoever.
I sort of kind of think that to an extent it may have. I mean, I think this is one of those movies that it is very it's self-aware to the fact that it's about making movies. So, you know, on movies that are about that, for the most part, have a hard time taking off, because it really is like where you almost feel like you're the insider, you sort of kind of get it. And this one is such time period sensitive that, you know, to talk about Busby Berkeley and to talk about, and again, I you know, who's the character that Scarlett Johansson,
Esther Williams,
you know, I was talking about this just today when I got in speaking to one of the staff. You know, not realizing that, you know, Esther Williams and swimming movies, that was a part of that culture. They were popular. They were bringing money in. And this was before synchronized swimming was even an itch as an idea, as an Olympic event being done. And Busby Berkeley musicals and all that, unless you have some semblance of film history, you could look at this and you could look at the swimming scene and go, the hell is this? Like, oh, you know, I saw something. I may have seen something like this in, The History of the World Part 1, where Mel Brooks also, like, makes, you know,
makes fun of it.
If you're unfamiliar, yes, we've seen Spartacus or the Ten Commandments or you know, we've seen movies of like Quo Vadis, Ben-Hur.
Who's seen those? Not me.
Well, again, it's Cleopatra. I mean,
battle epics.
These were like big epic movies of the time that were very popular, that brought this CinemaScope look, this big Vista Vision and Cinerama into light, which it's funny how it's sort of somewhat come back today. But that style of filmmaking, I think if the more in tune with the film history, I think the more that you would enjoy the movie. It's what kept me going along when I wasn't laughing as much as I had hoped to be. Mm-hmm. So I think it could be a hindrance. I think it's so in that it could leave some people out.
Zach, do you have a strong opinion one way or the other on this?
You know, I didn't ever think that it went too far into the world of filmmaking for the general audience to get it. I think because the general audience has an understanding more or less nowadays of how movies are made, especially with the invention since YouTube and home video cameras and everything. So the more inside the system stuff I don't think it was a problem. If anything, I think it was too broad at times and didn't hit into the specifics enough.
For me, Frances McDormand as the editor working on a moviola, like, unless you know about editing and what that entails to cut a film right where it needs to be cut and to loop in whatever sound, I mean, her scenes were hysterical. But, you know, that day is long gone how to edit that. And to me, it's funnier if you're aware of what that character had to go through other than her just being comedic.
Yeah, but I think at the end of the day, people know what a film reel is. Like, okay, maybe kids under 18 don't know, but this movie wasn't really for them anyway. I think anyone over the age of 18 knows what a film reel is at the very minimum, and that would have allowed that would give them the access to just get the joke, even if you don't know exactly how editing works. And then by the end of it, it's a scarf getting caught in a machine gag, which anybody watching can observe. And that's good writing, is when you can have the joke hit multiple levels. Anybody gets the scarf got caught in a machine, shouldn't wear scarves.
Yeah.
And then the people who know what's going on can appreciate it on a different level.
Well, let's talk about what's going on, right? So the 1950s, it's a huge transition. They made note of it by the Lockheed guy that movies could potentially die out. Obviously, we know that's not the case. They're still alive and hopefully well today. But it was a big battle between, you know, movie theaters and TV starting to pop up. And it was also, as Marissa mentioned, that's why the whole communist subplot got into this. We were at the height of McCarthyism and the Red Scare. And by the way, there's 50sweb.com and filmsite.org are kind of two great resources to find out more about these various things. Speaking of Busby Berkeley, Zach provided a clip from the Million Dollar Mermaid, which is what Scarlett Johansson's character is parodying. So, whenever you're ready, Zach.
Bring that up for you right now.
Well, so we
synchronized swim.
There we go.
Synchronized swim.
It's the biggest, most exciting water show ever staged. Specifically filmed in Technicolor. Esther Williams, Victor Mature, Walter Pigeon,
David Bryan, Donna Cochran,
and here, Million Dollar Mermaid. Another big musical.
I mean, just like you saw the swimming through, like, big on screen and stuff like that. I mean, the thing that I first thought of was, just because this is my own experience, was History of the World Part 1 and the Swimming Nuns.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what, yeah. That's,
yeah, I mean, it's a parody of this exact thing,
right.
But that was my first thought. But everything down to the fact that she comes out of the water with her hair dry, which they did at the time just by reversing the shot. They would just lower her in dry and then reverse the film. It's all there. When you look at the scene that they did.
Interesting, because they didn't film it that way in Hail Caesar.
Did they not?
Hail Caesar.
Right? She comes out of the water.
Yeah, she comes out of the water dry.
Yeah, she comes out of the water because it was... We're seeing the reverse of what they filmed. Like, the technique is, we film her this way, but when we're playing it back, we're going to play it backwards.
Yeah. That's interesting. What I liked about the technique of this movie was that I liked when they were specific and we were watching the movie as a movie rather than filming it. So fair enough. Other movies like this were Annie Get Your Gun, 2 Weeks with Love, Call Me Mister, 2 Tickets to Broadway, Small Town Girl. And the other fun fact that I learned, Judy Garland and him did not get along.
Interesting.
So that's a fun bit of history for you.
I understand.
Yeah. Anyone know more than that?
It's known that Judy or Ms. Garland had her issues, and at times she was not easy to direct or work together with.
Tour that it worked so it wouldn't be so simple.
So,
but also she was a name. Absolutely. She was a face.
Sure.
She had actual remarkable talent, so they had to work with her.
Yeah,
oh, despite.
Yeah.
You know, how difficult she may have been.
It happens to extent today. I mean, you know, people can be complete jerks on set to people and have their meltdowns. Lord knows, a lot of it's been captured on phones and then broadcast everywhere. So, you know, it still happens today a lot that some actors... some actors are just not as nice as you would hope to be when you meet them, if you meet them.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if this goes into the production aspect, but for the pool scene, they actually filmed that at the Sony lot where the big tank still exists, where they used to film the Esther Williams films.
Nice. And they used over 100 people.
Yeah. And they used over 110K lights to light the whole pool.
That's a lot of light.
It's a lot of light.
Bet you the water was warm.
It was indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Zach, do you like Westerns? Because I know you said you would watch the Western of it, but, you know, that was only from the selections given to you. Do you generally like Westerns?
Yeah, I enjoy Westerns. I wouldn't call myself an expert in them. I think there are massive gape like holes in the movies I've seen of classic Westerns. Like I've Dirty Have Secret, never seen Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Just never got to it.
So yeah, I mean, so that movie in particular, right? That's the spaghetti Western, and those came about later. Those are more of the '60s and things like that, into the '80s, and done by Italian Europeans.
Sergio Leone.
Yeah,
of course.
And, I mean, I have to admit, for me, I'm actually not as familiar with the 50s Westerns because of, again, that combination of musical and Western.
Right.
You know, I'm not necessarily the biggest fan personally. But, again, you had great, great movies like Arizona Cowboy, Gunsmoke, Broken Arrow, Desperado. Dimitri, any of these that you've seen?
You know, I mean, there's one, too. I mean, one of the... Another well-known musical type was, I believe it's called "Paint Your Wagon Red," with starred Clint Eastwood, who had to sing. But you know, I mean, the westerns that I'm akin to, like my favorite, "The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance," is fantastic. You know, I'm John Ford, "The Searchers," and then of course there's the original "True Grit," which the Coen brothers made. Fantastic remake of True Grit. You know, Gunfight at the OK Corral, of course, the High Plains Drifter, you know, the Clint Eastwood movies, all the way up until Unforgiven. Those are the ones that I was more or less brought up on, the ones that were really big CinemaScope kind of movies. I love The Searchers. The Searchers is such a great movie. And Look and Feel, you know, or Odors, as they were called, you know, they're not as, they don't translate so much as well today unless there's, you know, unless they're very over-actionized. But a lot of these things are a lot of people on horseback. going from town to town. But Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, again, one of the best, what can be argued is one of the best Westerns. Filmed with Robert Redford and Paul Newman. You know, all of these movies, if you haven't seen, you should definitely check them out.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the big aspects of, you know, the 50s in transitioning and combating TV was all... You kind of made mention of it, CinemaScope, VistaVision, all that. Because you worked at Technicolor, I'll just let you go to town on... explaining all of these.
Yeah, well, no, you're absolutely right. It was a big deal, and this was actually a theme that I thought was going to be better explored in this movie, because when television was coming out, it was almost like when MTV came out, it was video killed the radio star. And people actually thought that cinema was going to go away because television was going to keep people in their homes. So the film community had come up with you can call them gimmicks. But they came up with making the experience unlike what you're going to get at TV. It's so funny because today we have the same argument. We have the same argument of getting people to go to see the cinematic experience other than seeing a movie on your iPad or your dumb phone or whatever it is. The same rules apply today. It's just so funny. And so Hollywood came up with Cinerama, completely immersing you in this. But you had great directors who used this visual medium to such aplomb, and you got great stories. And then 3D came out. You know, 3D was another reason was invented because of the TV, because of television. And again, you got to parallel it to today. 3D is back, and it's not going anywhere, and it's to keep audiences going.
We have a picture of the 3D. And the only reason I bring it up, like, it looks like such a marketing campaign, but they just look so weirdly uncomfortable because it's all people in suit and ties advertising this 3D. Right. Like, that's when I think of going to the movies and seeing anything, I don't picture that at all.
Yeah, people dressed up more when they went out back in the 50s. You know what can I say? Same as in the 40s, but
what's with the one guy?
Which
who's
one?
Just wearing sunglasses in the middle. He's not going to get the 3D.
He's probably blind. He could be blind. There's a C and I dog.
It's so real that he can touch it. That's what it is.
He got the special glasses. He paid extra, much like today, where you can buy BB-8 glasses when you see Star Wars. I don't know. I'm just making it up. But, you know, so 3D, and then people like William Castle, you know, excelled in making gimmicky movies like The Tingler, in which
tell me about this movie.
Well, The Tingler actually was a horror movie. It was a B-horror movie in which William Castle set up in theaters in which certain scenes of the movie, the audience members would get shocked. Like they would literally feel a shock in their seats whenever The Tingler came around. I mean, all of these were gimmicks to get people to go to the movies. You know, some of them worked, some of them didn't. Smell-O-Rama or Smell-O-Vision was another scratch 40. And sniff kind of a deal that John Waters even used in one of his movies. You know, and then we still have the gimmicks in a sense today. We're going back to that. You know, back in the 70s, it was Sensoround. It was Sensoround, which would literally, like, were bass speakers that went from floor to ceiling. They were all bass, and they were the corners of the theater, and they would like whenever an earthquake would happen, your seat would rumble. Today we don't need that because we have Dolby surround Auro immersive sound. It's the same thing. So everything that heightens that movie experience, it was great. I'm so happy that we had Cinerama Dome come up. Today's Quentin Tarantino, The Hateful Eight. He went back old school in filming Hateful Eight in 70mm, which was a big deal back at the time. And using Technicolor was huge because we did a breakdown of The Wizard of Oz, right? That was a great show. And that was the use of Technicolor because it made vibrancy. It brought things. You were able to see such fine detail in color. And remember, when television first came out, it was black and white. So it was cinema that made this transition into color. It's like, you're going to see something that's different than what you're going to see on TV.
Yeah.
And the movie, the long and the short of it, the movie industry did not die. It weathered the storm. And in fact, then came to use television as its advertising, because now the studios buy advertising on television to tell you to go to the movies.
Yeah.
So.
And then, you know, the other big kind of part of all of that, you know, just like Hail Caesar is, this big epic. And so Zach brought in a clip from Ben-Hur. You want to intro it real fast while you bring it up?
I mean, I pulled this one just because it just shows how exact they were Hail Caesar might as well have been Ben-Hur. So,
fair enough.
Let's take a look.
Let's watch George Clooney.
It looks identical. It's the whole thing with the Roman soldiers.
It's pretty much shot for shot.
Yeah.
You know, going the locals trying to get water.
Wait! And then the Roman soldiers.
Oh, what if him?
It's Roman missing that comedic first. Element just a little.
Yeah, a little different.
Such dramatic music, too.
But, yeah.
Yeah, and I would highly recommend, because every now and then the Cinerama Dome here in L.A., and if you have something similar in your neck of the woods, you know, they will bring back, they will show Ben-Hur in that format, or Spartacus, or one of my favorite farces, it's a mad world, and they'll show it in its original form, and it really is night and day, when you watch and how vibrant and how big, and it was like you said, Zach, the detail, well, there's the detail in that type of filmmaking, and what the Coen brothers did fabulously is, like, they know their film history, so they could make a scene like that work. But the detail, there was no computer-generated graphics. These are all extras. The sets are real. There's a lot of matte paintings going on. Really is, you know, it really is a sight to see because of all the time and money that was put into it. And the returns for a lot of them were pretty big. I think the biggest flop of that type of era was Cleopatra, a Cecil B. DeMille movie. So, but you know, if you have the chance and you're in Los Angeles and you see the Cinerama Dome doing a throwback kind of a thing, you should check it out. Really, it's trust me, you'll enjoy it. You'll have a good time.
There you go. From Dimitri. Let's take a step back and kind of talk about the Coen brothers, because we've talked a lot about the movie, we've compared it and so forth, but we haven't yet talked about the Coen brothers and their process and what inspired them and what got them here to Hail Caesar. You know, this one in particular has been meriting in their mind for a long time. It was originally supposed to be part of the Numbskull trilogy, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and Intolerable Cruelty. You know, so that was around back in 2004 when that was originating. It was also supposed to be more about the 1920s, not necessarily about the 1950s. And then, you know, as years passed, finally in 2013, they said, okay, we're now going to do this movie. And that's the movie we have.
Yeah, and also because George Clooney has worked with the Coen brothers for so many times.
Right.
George Clooney, in interviews, would say, yes, my next big film is Hail Caesar. He kept promoting it himself, and the Coen brothers were like, okay, now we actually have to write it. Because George Clooney is saying that he's doing it, so I was like, shoot, we actually got to get this film going.
Yeah, and his story, too, as to how he got involved with the Coen brothers is I find it amusing, you know, because he was working on that movie Three Kings. Obviously, he had some semblance of who these Coen brothers were, and they wanted him to be in a movie. And they just approached him and said, we'd like you to be in a movie. And he said, yep. They go, well, don't you want to read the script? He's like, nope. If it's you guys making the movie, I want to be in your movie. And, you know, they had a little bit of dialogue, and next thing you know, he's a Coen brother favorite.
Yeah.
Which, again, I think makes watching Coen brother movies enjoyable, because they work with their quote unquote friends. Francis McDormand is all the only one missing out of this Hail Caesar was I can't think of the other gentleman from Fargo, the redheaded man, the car salesman.
I'm not sure.
William H. Macy.
That's it.
Yes. Yeah.
That's it. You know what I did find interesting? Like I said, I stated earlier, I'm not necessarily the biggest Coen fanatic, but that doesn't mean I don't enjoy their movies. I found it interesting that early on they wrote a lot of the movies, but Joel was the one directing them. Now they get billed as, you know, a Coen brothers film, and so there's a lot less that they did actually together as directors, which I found interesting. So we have that list. If you download the show notes, you can kind of get that full breakdown. And in fact, I believe we should Picture 19, Zach, kind of has a little bit of their breakdown of stuff. But I want to kind of let you guys discuss and almost debate. What's your favorite? You know, what's your favorite Coen Brothers movies and why? Like, what drew you to them?
I think one of them, or more so, is like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. Mm-hmm. Especially, I think that might be an easy go-to for everybody. But I enjoyed watching that film because it's three completely ridiculous guys in different situations. So I think it's the short stories that are we see these guys and follow their lives and how they interact with the crazy people that they come across. I found it very entertaining and memorable in ways because the audience loves these characters and just how they go about situations. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the quirkiness of it that's just really, overall, it's a feel-good movie.
Yeah, yeah. For me, well, I'm a big fan. I do enjoy Blood Simple just because of its noirish. But then, you know, but I have to go, my favorite is Raising Arizona. Raising Arizona to me too, and it couldn't have come out at a better time period. Again, you know, the 80s was willing to take a risk on trying to do that type of a zany slapstick comedy, and it's when that kind of slapstick comedy still was viable and worked, and the Coen brothers utilizing Nicolas Cage and Holly Hunter, they were fantastic together, and I just love the spirit, the speed, the zaniness of that movie. So for me, it goes back to 1987's Raising Arizona.
Fair enough. And Zach?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely put Oh Brother, Where Art Thou up there. The one I would mostly want to talk about, though, I think because it's overlooked so much and it's one of my favorites, is A Serious Man.
Yes.
I loved that movie when it came out. I think it had the luck of just hitting me at a point in my life where it's just like I was perfectly primed for it, of like I was questioning a lot of things and relationships and faith and all of that stuff was sort of like it was a very cool take on all of those ideas. I think it's very well constructed. There's a lot of it's one of those that's like heavier on the drama but still has that comedy aspect. Also growing up Jewish, all the bar mitzvah gags. Spot on. But I mean, between like that, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, The Big Lebowski, Fargo, the Hardsucker Proxy is the one I always forget was theirs. But I like really? That, but I love that movie.
Yeah, I love Hardsucker Proxy as well, and a fantastic performance by Paul Newman, and the very quotable, well, you know, it's for kids. You know, I love saying that today. How about you, Phil?
Again, I'm not necessarily as well versed. You know, I thought No Country for Old Men, you know, that's when I really started kind of knowing the Coen brothers as the Coen brothers. And so I'm more familiar with that work. I'm intrigued by, you know, the more recent history where now they're also writing but allowing other people to direct their movies. So Unbroken, I thought, was very good by Angelina Jolie. That mm-hmm. they wrote. You guys talked about, I wasn't part of the panel, but Bridge of Spies, Steven Spielberg yeah. directed it, but they wrote it. So it's going to be interesting to see them continue in that way where they'll, you know, potentially make more of their movies, but also have other people direct some of their writing. And, you know, that'll be interesting how other people interpret their writing, because obviously we've been blessed to see their interpretation of their own writing.
Yeah, I'm very surprised that nobody brought up Big Lebowski, because I would think that...
I name-checked it.
I'm sorry?
I name-checked it.
You name-checked it. I mean, you know, I mean, it is a... It's definitely probably... I mean, there have been movies where the characters about the Big Lebowski, yeah. whereas the characters try to go on a similar journey. I mean, it's one of those cult followings that the Big Lebowski has. And again, it's sort of going back to that noirish kind of take, but you get such great characters, again, using John Goodman, John Turturro, who, I mean, is anybody familiar with Barton Fink? That was just a weird movie, you know. But they always just bring something... Like, there isn't a movie that I can say that I, like, really hate from them. There are degrees of how much I like them. I'll like some of their movies better than others. But, you know, if it says Coen Brothers on it, you're in for some semblance of a ride.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
And you read an article by Variety, Dimitri, that kind of highlighted also how they watch movies. So you want to kind of share the some of that stuff?
Yeah, again, and this goes back to, you know, they were asked in this article, how do you, you know, what's the, how do you watch your movies? What do you try to do? And there's big debate going on today about this, as there was back in the 50s. And, you know, Joel, we like to watch them in movie theaters. We don't get to see as many as we used to. There's this little insidious thing with the Academy where they send you DVDs of everything. What I love about this, the further on quote on this, is that if I were Academy president, I would outlaw screeners. I would abolish that thing. He goes, and he's right. It's too convenient. It's too convenient. Something you spend a lot of time and effort making look good on a big screen, yet most people are watching them on their shitty little screen, like an iPad. I like this, and yeah, I agree with him. And these guys are, you know, they're obviously film historians, film nuts. So, you know, I agree. When you get somebody like Roger Deakins, that's why somebody outside asked me, would you see this? Would you see Hail Caesar on the big screen? Absolutely. When you get Roger Deakins to be your cinematographer and it's a Coen Brothers movie, why wouldn't you want to see this on the big screen? You know, it's going, whether you love it or hate it, the experience of seeing it, and like, it was great that you brought up Ben-Hur, because for our audience, that's a great, you picked a great scene, Zach and Phil, because you see the amount of detail that the Coens put into making it look as it were, and there's a grandness to it that sometimes is not prevalent in today's cinema as much.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love that.
I agree. So there's a great article on Vogue that kind of compares the various people to, and we kind of made mention of it, but just to kind of hit various things home. So Josh Brolin, Eddie Mannix was a real person, although a little bit earlier. This is his third, this is Clooney's fourth collaboration, but Brolin, this is his third, so he's getting up there in terms of being a go-to guy for the Coen brothers. There was another thing that you found out, you were able to kind of dig deeper on how his involvement, Dimitri.
About Josh Brolin's, is Eddie Mannix?
Yes.
Yeah, this came from, the NPR did a wonderful interview with Josh. And, you know, they talked about the difference in the real Eddie Mannix and his Eddie Mannix. And apparently, you know, the real Eddie Mannix, and I'll be honest, I don't know much history about the real Eddie Mannix, but apparently he wasn't an upstanding gentleman.
He was not.
He was a fixer, but you didn't want him coming around fixing your problems. And Brolin's approach, he acknowledged that. He says, no, he wasn't a good guy, and I love that you talk that he's pure as it gets when you look at the real Eddie Mannix, and Eddie Mannix, the real guy, was pretty ruthless, but this was more of like an amalgamation of Louis B. Mayer, and there was a PR guy, and Louis B. Mayer was a guy that studio head, and he picked projects, but back in the 40s and 50s, there was a lot of fixing going on, and again, when you had those deals, you had to do, like, the studio had to think about what would be best for that studio. And there was a line in which they were trying to get an actor, and they couldn't get him on loan from another studio because they wouldn't allow it.
They could have if they would change, and they're like, we can't give her away.
We're not going to give her away. And, like, those were some of the problems. L.A. Confidential is great, too, because it's also about that time period, and it talks about how publicity, like, you know, what that can do to a picture and how you try to hide the publicity, what you do to cover it up. And the whole thing, I don't know if you got into Scarlett Johansson
character
about it too. Like that is so, the absurdity of it, and Zach, you had mentioned it earlier, the absurdity of it, it's because it is so Hollywood, of adopting your own baby and such, that it's not out of the realm, and yeah, I just think that, and with Josh Brolin, he gets it, and he understood that. I liked how he was not. I liked how he was more of an approachable guy. Yeah, I think it would have been a different movie had he been the real life Eddie Mannix character. Don't you?
Yeah, I think the difference is that if he had been unlikable, the whole movie would have been. We would have just been mad. The fact that we could at least like connect to this guy because we understand when our coworkers are nuts,
right?
And they prevent us from doing our job. I see Marissa with a big smile as if she understands. But if he had just been a jackass,
right.
There's no way we'd ever. We just because everyone else is a jackass. We can't. You can't have a movie with all jackasses. Then you're just doing It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah, true. And I did like that they gave him the conundrum of, you know, he had this job offer for Lockheed, which is sort of funny because, again, that sort of kind of goes into the theme of Lockheed's coming into town, and they were supposed to be the big thing, and they were for a while. But the movies have outlasted Lockheed as well, because Lockheed doesn't exist anymore. But I like how he had problems to fix, and we saw a nice little scene when he was at home, and he actually had conversations with his wife. This is a man that was a churchgoer. He's a family man. He was a religious man. He went to church. I smoked cigarettes. I lied to my wife. And you're right. If the guy was an asshole, there really wouldn't be much to root for.
I think it was more so if the guy was a jerk, if he was a true jerk, he wouldn't be the one fixing problems. He'd let it be like, all right, that's your problem.
Yeah. You know, and moving on to George Clooney, one of the things that they said about George Clooney, the Coen brothers did, was that he's just, there's no vanity in him.
No.
Right. And that's not, he comes off that way. One of the things that, you know, no matter what movie he's promoting, no matter what movie he's in, and just his interactions, he's just seems like a genuine guy and doesn't take it, you know, wants to do a good job, but doesn't ultimately take it that serious. And so, I think that's, it shows on screen with what they were able to do with him. So much so that, it was George in particular who wanted the Caesar skirt to just go shorter and shorter, as short as it could.
Yeah. I find that really fun because it just shows like how game George Clooney was for this character. He understands he's not smart. He's just a likable guy.
Yeah.
But it just shows that, I mean, and also maybe it's just the relationship he's established with the Coen brothers that he's down for anything.
Yeah.
And to add more, just when it comes down to wardrobe, to make the costume look even more ridiculous, it shows just how fun Baird was just to laugh with.
Yeah, and I think that if you follow George Clooney all, he has a sense of humor. He has very close friends too that he seems he can open up with and be that actor. So George Clooney is a star in his own right, but sometimes I don't understand sometimes the flack that he sometimes gets for certain movies. One of our co-hosts, John Comerford, and I, we always talk about Monuments Men. And that movie got eviscerated. Both of us are sitting there going, I don't get why. I don't understand why it was, like, Clooney did a good job directing it. And sometimes, I don't know with him. Sometimes he seems to get picked on for whatever, but he has a sense of humor about certain things. In fact, in the Bill Murray Christmas special, he made fun of Monuments Men. To an extent. And, you know, I always like seeing him on screen. He has a good presence. He's good an interviewer, too.
Oh, yeah, he's great. I think George Clooney, he's at this state in his career where he can just laugh at himself. You know, and it's in a genuine way because, you know, Hollywood can be ridiculous anyways. It's more so just have fun with whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
But I mentioned it earlier. I mean, that monologue scene, with the exception of him getting the last line wrong because the writer switched it, and that was a thing that they made note of earlier, right? It's the in Act 1, and then Act 3 is where it comes back. It wouldn't have worked if he was still in that comedy bit. He needed to sell us on him as a star in this movie, but we're reminded both at the same time that Bard is a amazing actor, and this is why he is the star of Hail Caesar. And it's also, wow, George Clooney is the star that he is in today's world.
Yeah,
I loved how that scene played out, though, because seeing the movie within a movie, you also saw the shots of the production crew, and they're like really getting into it, nodding their head, and that's what it's really like on set when there's a really good take. You just get engrossed. You're like, yes, that was amazing, and then it immediately gets ruined. It really felt like production.
It really did, and you know, it was such a great monologue that he did. For whatever reason, I snapped back to, because I liked how they went back to like the people on set, and then it reminded me, it just snapped me back to The Verdict and Paul Newman giving this amazing monologue about justice at the end of that movie. And I was like going, wow, I wonder if at the end of that, like, I wonder if people who were on set watching him just do this, like, if they were just enthralled and they were like, okay, yeah, he's not guilty or whatever. You know, and to an extent, I got to see a little bit of this being done when I worked on the movie Contact. You know, I got to see one of my childhood favorites, Jodie Foster, perform. And for me, it's just a thrill to sit. I was like on set watching her perform, and it was amazing. And seeing people like Angela Bassett, when they can deliver and act, and they make it look easy. And George Clooney just seems to make it look effortless as well. And it's a great thing. And I can imagine too, like on the actual set of Hail Caesar, when he was doing that, they had to have been like, he's nailing it. And is he going to get the end right? Cause that one thing of dialogue, cause that's where the comedy comes in, and that's timing. And he nailed it. Yeah, nailed it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Clooney's really great. Anytime you give him an emotion, whatever it is, he'll like whatever you need. He seems to be able to deliver. And well.
Yeah.
Like, he's the biggest movie star for a reason. I really loved in that whole sequence, I don't know if we've mentioned it, but when they ask the guy playing Jesus, like, are you a principal? I think so.
That was a good bit.
And it was smart. They don't show his face. All you see is his feet. It plays with the whole rest of the movie.
You get a different type of lunch.
Yeah,
yeah. Wait, that's a different kind of lunch.
Very, very real.
It's very production, and that's what I love about movies within movies.
Extries don't get
extries.
Yeah.
Extries don't get hot lunches.
That's right. Them extras. That was I thought that was a bit funny, but you can't trust them extras.
Can't trust them.
I do want to. We haven't really talked about Channing Tatum in particular, and I thought we've compared him to Gene Kelly, and we talked about him as part of the communist cell, but his little scene, it was just so brilliant, and they really didn't know what they were going to do in that moment because they were shooting, and then just. They just got to the day almost, and you know whether or not that's 100% fact can't be entirely certain. But that's the way Coen Brothers joke about it coming together. And we do. Zach did bring a clip from New York, New York to help compare it to.
It's pretty much like just like the others. Like they paid such like strategic homage to specific films, and this was another one of them.
Indeed.
I mean, right down to the costumes. They're not in a bar, but it's the same.
It's the same feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Was it as, did it have, how should I put this? Did it have any of the gay tones that Channing Tatum's character had?
I don't remember the last time I saw New York, New York all the way through.
Fair enough.
But, yeah, it's three guys on a romp through New York, so maybe it's implied. If they go down to the village, then you know.
But I think it's also just down to the physical movements of the actors too, just how they play with each other and how they hit each other out of friendliness and
right.
how they, you know, if one falls over, they'll catch each other. So literally the physical movements are pretty much the same too.
Yeah, the physical and the choreography and according to Channing Tatum, like we all know through cinema, you know, and I mean, he cut his teeth on Step Up. That was, I believe, his right. first movie. And, you know, we saw that, well, he can dance, so we know he can dance. What he really couldn't do. And he, okay, yes, with he Maddie can do Mike. That too.
He does a lot of dancing.
He does do a lot of dancing, but the one type of dance he wasn't really well versed in was tap dancing. And, you know, he said that was the hardest thing he had to do, get about 10 years worth of tap dancing in about 3 months. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he carried it off.
And singing as well.
And he carried it off. It was a really great scene. Again, for me, that payoff for that character when he shows up at the end, I was like, oh, okay. You know, okay. But that, again, the vignette of that scene and the Coen brothers' homage to that type of a movie, you know, it was brilliant because it's so spot on.
See, I didn't think of New York. I thought of a Shirley Temple's film because she was big into musicals as well. And there is I'm completely blanking on the name, but there's a film where she's with a bunch of sailors. Mm-hmm. And it felt like that in a bar having fun and singing and, you know, drinking beers. Hmm. So, but again, it goes back to the 40s, 50s at that time.
Yeah.
That was, I believe, Captain January?
Yes! That's the one. I was a big Shirley Temple's fan.
So they had superhero movies way back then, too, huh?
I'm kidding.
Captain
As we're kind of, we got to cram some of our stuff in a little bit, and we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the cinematography and also the visual effects and other aspects of it. So we'll skip ahead to some of that. Dan Schuracker. There's a great article with him in TheVerge.com, and he's the visual effects supervisor. And so when you think of this movie, you don't really think of a lot of visual effects, but the way he broke it down was there's modern-day things that they need to put in that you couldn't see. So the lasso when he's waiting for his date, that would be an example of that. Then there's the period effects that they had to do, which was the matte paintings of Rome. And you guys kind of talked about that, of how in the old days they would have to do it. And then there was the gray area of what was real and what wasn't. And, you know, there's pictures that we have here. So this one is of Capitol Pictures. And if you go to TheVerge.com, you can actually kind of...
you can use your mouse to swipe the thing so that what you're looking on screen right now is a split screen. Sort of a split screen thing, and where that dividing line is with your mouse, if you wipe it either left or right, you can see the movie version.
Yeah.
And then you can see what the actual shot looked like while filming.
Which I thought was really cool.
It's a great, great concept. I wish there was more stuff like that. I mean, The Verge they get that right. It's a great thing if you love movies the way we do, which why else are you watching the show? Is really cool. The other cool thing, too, about the visual effects was the submarine.
Yeah.
I did not know. Like that was a real... It was not a miniature. And it was... How they built... It was great. How they... This tank and having Channing Tatum's character climb up on there. But when you look at The Verge, that submarine was not there.
It was not.
I did love his jump onto the ladder.
Yeah. It was fantastic. So elegant.
Perfect. So, in terms of writing, it's a perfect comedic callback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Such absolutely. A performer.
All the time. Roger Deakins was the cinematographer. And, you know, there's so much to discuss with him. He has such a big history of it. But before we discuss him in particular, there's a bunch of images that Marissa was able to pull. That have kind of a breakdown of various frames. And so, Marissa, I'm just going to let you kind of take it away and call forth the images as you see them.
Oh, yes. So, of course, Roger Deakins, a very well-established cinematographer. For the particular scene where when Baird comes back after, you know, leaving the communists, and he comes back to the studios, and we see Eddie chastising him pretty much, and Dimitri, as you say, getting slapping the communism out of him. Roger Deakins posted his visual breakdown of how for the staging between those two, but also with the lights, just the way he thinks, he's like the light is in this particular area. These two actors are sitting here and here. He put on Photoshop, I believe. He made a mock-up of what visual blocking he wanted. And that's out
so
to
that's
the world.
The picture
this is the photo that we're looking at. This is what his concept development of how he envisioned the placement of everything. And then if you keep going through the photos, just more behind the scenes of you have that clapboard. And there are particular shots where he would make notes on top of each frame of his, you know, mental thoughts, like a light is here, this is where the shading goes, this is the type of light we're going to use in this position during each shot. So for like 5,600K, goodness, and then 3,200K. So he has it so down to the particular light and details of how, you know, scenes he wants to film.
Yeah,
Camera angles, what lens he wants to use during the office scene, because it moves around in the scene. These actors move around the whole space of a small area, so the lighting is going to change, especially in natural light as well.
And being that he shot on film as well, that affects. Well, that changes in today's world. It changes everything. You know, where a cinematographer truly has to have the lighting down, because if you mess up while filming on film, you can't really fix it in post so much. You know, I found it that it was interesting that he's like, you know, he was actually scared of going back to film. And an interview would say, well, it's sort of like riding a bike. He goes, yeah, that's true, but I don't know how to ride a bike. And he goes, yeah, it's very scary now to shoot on film, because it is less forgiving if you mess up. But he is truly, you know, one of these days, I believe he's going to get either a Cinematography Achievement Award for all his fantastic work. He's definitely one of the best.
I mean, just recently, Jarhead, Revolutionary War, Skyfall, Prisoners, Cesario, Shawshank Redemption, Beautiful Mind, Unbroken, you know, and
he's worked in animation. He did the original How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is a guy who has an eye and knows how to light and gets the shots done. I've said this a million times, too. Skyfall is perhaps the most beautiful Bond movie to watch. Like, if you're not a Bond fan, I still recommend you see Skyfall because of his lighting, his use of dark, light, shadow. He's an amazing director. It's one of the best parts of Sicario. Because... again, some of those shots
it's
are
gritty,
just
but beautiful.
Beautiful.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah.
And these shots really help. Like, Marissa, thanks for bringing these in, because they really do show off how detailed you need to be a cinematographer of his caliber. I mean, just like this one with the film noir logo. Like, he's like, this is what shows it. You see the light hitting his shoulders with the arrows and everything with that. And then, like, this one with Scarlett Johansson. And the... he planned out, like, okay, that light's not coming from nowhere just because it looks good. It would be from a lamp.
Mm-hmm.
So the lamp is going to shine. It's going to hit her exactly in this way and in this intensity, and he colors it in. And that's the prep that it takes to be a Roger Deakins.
Yes, his visual eye and how and the execution of it all is brilliant.
It is.
I like the fact that, you know, I mean... you made mention of it, but most cinematographers, right? I've heard a lot of them come out and say, like, film is the way to go, film is still pure, blah blah blah. I like the fact that he's one of those guys, like, no, I don't want to do it, let me shoot. And to the point of, like, hey, you know what, they wanted me to shoot film, so I shot film. But if they asked me to do it on a cell phone, I would have done it on a cell phone.
They actually talked about, you know, do we want to go digital on this? But and the Coen brothers, and I get it. He has a great quote. You know, he was talking about filming this, and you know, they had to be true to a degree. But on the other hand, we're also making a film that had to sort of be cohesive as one piece. Ethan put it best. I think he said, it's not a tribute to filmmaking. It's a film set in that time. So although we were kind of mimicking some of the old movies, especially the Westerns and stuff, to go too far with it, I think, would pull the audience out of the overall movie. And to me, that's the finest homage that you can make. Like when you, you know, it's... And he's right. If you went too far, then it really would cross that line of almost being parodying, where in fact, like doing certain scenes and like that bluff, that bluff where the house sat atop of, you know, he was using North by Northwest as a thing. So their film history comes into their play, and all of their years and knowledge of movies. They get it. They can do it right, so that, wow, how did they do it back then? And let's make sure, because we are that period piece, let's make sure that when we do a tribute, that it's not gonna look too much as a fake or a phony. I appreciate you could appreciate this detail and work. And he's doing, I think, Blade Runner 2, coming out, which you can't wait for. You know.
So, I mean, there's obviously a lot of stuff still left on the production side, apart from just cinematography. But as we kind of, unfortunately, time starts to run short for us, let's get into the promotion, the box office. Because there's still, there's a lot in there that we can definitely just talk about. And so I made mention at the top that Forbes came out with an article that had the sentiment that most of us have been saying, that the trailer did not match what the tone is. And so their quote is, every trailer presented it as an all-star team, a group of wacky celebrities from the golden age of Hollywood joining forces to save one of their kidnapped own in the form of George Clooney. Less movie industry, more of a madcap comedic caper version of Argo. The mismatch between the story being presented through the marketing and the story that was actually told may have created enough of a cognitive dissonance to make a larger audience wary of plunking down their hard-earned money when they weren't sure what they were getting.
Well, I would go even farther and say may have caused. I mean, when you take a look at it, it's rare that you see this sort of schism between Rotten Tomatoes gave the movie an 80%. So these are critics who enjoy the Coen brothers. And again, they have a knowledge of the film industry, okay? The CinemaScore rating on this movie was a C-. A C-. That is low. That means audiences came out saying, What the hell is that? Like, I didn't expect that. And I agree. I mean, it's one of the things that I came out of this movie going, I actually thought it was going to be more madcap. I thought this was sort of kind of going to have this all-star cast. The trailers were reminding me of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. There was going to be this madcap thing to save this one actor. I didn't realize it was going to be a day in the life of.
Yeah.
With all these various stories going on. And had I known that, I would have been prepped, and I probably would have enjoyed the movie more had I known that. But it's a cheat. They cheated it because I think they were afraid of their – I think the studio who released it, which was Sony Classics, I think that they got afraid. They didn't know how to market this movie, so they cheated it to try to get an opening weekend out of it. But they upset the audience, the movie going audience.
I think at the end of the day, like, it was really that a lot of trailers these days try to appeal to a wide audience. They try to be broad to just get people in the door. And if it's good once they get there, it almost doesn't matter if the trailer was misleading or not. I'm thinking what Simon Pegg was saying about, and we haven't seen this movie, so it's hard to draw the comparison, but what his comments on the trailer for Star Trek III, where the writer of the movie said that trailer does not represent the actual movie you're going to see. It was an attempt to appeal to the broad, And this movie, I think, unless you know what the Coen brothers are going to give you, like, this movie didn't surprise me from the marketing. I knew sort of, this is sort of what I expected. Maybe I thought it would be a little closer to Big Lebowski and it's like over the topness, but I knew just because of the names on it that we were not going to get this like cheesy little like romp through old time Hollywood.
Well, I wasn't expecting a cheesy romp. I was just more expecting, and if anybody could have carried it off, because this is what I was prior to going into it, I go, old Hollywood, it's a farce, which we haven't seen in a while. If anybody could handle this material and do it right because of their love of cinema, it would be the Coen brothers. It just, the movie that was delivered was a little bit different for me. And when we talk about marketing, you know, I can bring up a movie. Like, there was a movie that when I was at Lionsgate, we worked with a movie that was directed by William Friedkin. So you have a big name director. It had that Michael Shannon and Ashley Judd were in it. And the movie was called Bug. Okay. Bug. Mm-hmm. The way that movie was marketed, it was marketed as a William Friedkin horror movie. If you saw the trailers to that movie, you'd say, wow, it's William Friedkin going back to doing horror. The movie you got was a horrible movie. I mean, it just was, it couldn't have been so different, so far off than the marketing. And, you know, I think that happens every now and then with some of the movies. That's a movie that, you know, I just happen to vividly remember having to get the trailers up on screen. But, you know, Hollywood has to cheat movies in one way, shape, or form. I just wonder if, from a distribution standpoint, had they gone, like, if they started off a little bit more limited and not go so wide, right? And then give a more truer version of what this Coen Brothers movie was going to be, and then expand from there, because you'd get maybe better goodwill and audiences might like it more. I don't know. I don't know. But they were shooting. I agree with you, Zach. They were shooting for the, they were swinging for the fences. They were trying to get as many people.
We can safely say this.
Yeah.
The good news is they were number two in the box office. Mm-hmm. The bad news is it is not a good weekend when your number two is 6 million. No, 11.4 million. Sorry.
Yeah, 11.3 opening weekend number two. Yeah,
that's not a good number.
Yeah. No, I think for the trailer and marketing, I think they were, like you said, for the wide audience, I think they were trying to just settle on the fact that they had a big ensemble, mm-hmm, with name actors and actresses of today's time, and that's what appealed to people to bring to this movie, just the actors themselves, not the story, not the fact that it was another Coen brothers, it's just that there's big names in this film, so go see it.
Yeah,
I think the problem is, you know, it becomes this, like, yes, we like seeing these various people in movies, that's all well and good, but we like seeing them do something.
Right.
So don't just show me, like, picture of everyone that's in the damn movie. I want to see what they're doing and why it's worthwhile.
Yeah.
And the funny part, like, for the most part, each of them had a bit. Each of them was doing good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Each of them had their moment.
You know, and how hard is it to present a day in the life of this guy? You know, go back to, like, 80s trailers of, like, meet Eddie. Eddie is a fixer of Hollywood.
Right.
Meet all the people Eddie has to deal with daily.
Yeah.
Hey, Eddie. You know, and just cut to each of the people having to deal with them.
Yeah. No, I mean, there was a, I'm sure there is a way that they could have cut a trailer or chosen to market that movie in such a good way, but they chose to go this way. They chose to go, let's make it about George Clooney. Let's make it, it's going to be a farce. And we're going to have Jonah Hill, Scarlett Johansson, Josh Brolin, all people who are popular, including George Clooney. And let's sell the audience that. Like, we're going to hide the fact that there was no mention of communism, really, in the trailer at all.
Definitely
not. And so when this comes up in the movie, I was like, what the hell? Like, okay. You know, it's like, okay, I get what's going on here, but I had no idea that this was going there, and the pregnancy of, like, once I let the movie sit in, it makes sense, but going into it, I just feel a little bamboozled from the marketing.
Yeah, well, we need somebody to fix that, don't we?
We do.
We need to fix it.
Good marketing person.
So, as we wrap up, final thoughts. Why don't we start with you, Zach, in terms of final thoughts, where you think this movie stands in the Coen brothers'
filmography. I mean, it doesn't come anywhere near cracking my top five Coen brothers' movies. Ultimately, I think it's sort of forgettable. Like, we'll remember the wacky moments, probably, and the performances more than anything else. The story, I think, Dimitri, maybe down to the death of Mark, like, the idea of a movie star being kidnapped is funny, but since it wasn't central, like, that isn't going to be what we remember after seeing it in 5 years. It's not going to... Maybe I'll rewatch it at some point if I'm doing a Coen Brothers marathon, but outside of that, I don't expect to be rewatching it anytime soon.
All right, fair enough. Marissa?
I enjoyed this film. I enjoyed the characters because they were all, individually, they had interesting stories that kept me entertained throughout. For Coen Brothers, I'd put this, and I haven't seen a lot of Coen Brothers, I will say that, so I will put this up there with probably Burn After Reading. I think my favorite is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, but I really enjoyed Burn After Reading, and I actually enjoyed this one because I went in with not really knowing what to expect, and at the end of it, I walked away saying, hey, that was a fun movie.
Interesting.
Go ahead.
I think, for me, again, the movie didn't make me angry. I just wished... the marketing was a little bit more on point. I don't think they had to cheat it because I think that there was something there. There were parts of it that I really enjoyed. There were certain performances. I don't know if you talked about Robert Picardo as the rabbi. I thought that scene was great, and it still is Hollywood today, trying to get the opinions of various factions to make your movie, and then just going, oh my God, what a headache that can be.
Oh my God, the priest who had a comment about how realistic the chariots were.
Right.
It hurt. I heard it, and I was just like, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I will say this because I know you have a bit to say. You know, I love that scene only because even if you get these four people to sign off, even though they represent religious groups, that does still make it, it's still going to offend possibly somebody.
Yeah. And at times, studios will try hard to, you know, especially, and it just, once you start inviting those opinions in, like, you just saw Eddie Mannix's face was like, yeah, this might not have been the best idea. And so he's pretty much, okay, all right, I get it, we're done. So while it had scenes like that, while Ralph Fiennes' scenes were fantastic as Lawrence Lorenz, there are other parts that I didn't like as much. But what I will look forward to is I actually will go back and see this movie again, but after some time. I feel like now that I'm sort of kind of primed. So if by the time it comes on HBO or something, there might be a lot that I've forgotten about it. But at least now I know what the crux of this movie is. So I'll rewatch it. And it'll sort of kind of be like rewatching it with like a new pair of eyes. With a new mind to go into this and go, okay, I know what this movie's about. Let me rewatch this and maybe I'll like it more. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll like it more.
Absolutely.
So I'll give the Coen brothers... you know, that much. Maybe I'll like it more.
They've earned it.
Yeah.
You know, for me, I liked that it was fast-paced. It was a relatively short running time, you know, an hour and 40, which I thought was great. And I think part of that, I think they did cut down certain things. In particular, we talked about it, the Jonah Hill, Scarlett Johansson bit. I'm sure there was more, but they just need to move on. I enjoyed it, and what'll be interesting, I could see this, like, these clips going out onto YouTube and then being so much more popular than perhaps the movie. Just because that's, mm-hmm. you know, also the weird day and age we're living in, even though that's what the movie is trying to fight. And the other thing that I'm curious about, you guys at home, comment, please. I didn't necessarily need the narration. I thought it was too much. That was the one nitpick for me of, well, So...
The narration could have been used had they redone their marketing the good way. That's when the narration would have come in, like you said. they could have used that narration to set up the trailer, which would have been great in setting up our story, because we would have known that we're going in to see an old-time Hollywood fixer, mm-hmm. and this was his day.
I miss narration in trailers. Yeah. A lot of time there was trailers with, okay, this is what's happening, and we don't really get that anymore in trailers.
Meet Eddie Mannix. He's a fixer. Dad!
I'll rewrite it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's rewrite it. All right, guys. So that's about it for us. As mentioned, you know, please go rate and comment. Even if you've done so in the past, especially on iTunes, refresh that comment. Let us know how we're doing. We would like to, you know, kind of be judged on more recent work. Because we'd like to think we've improved over the years. If we haven't, let us know why. And also, like I said, in the, you know, there's pictures. So if you're listening on audio, or if you're on video and want to get the rundown, it's all there. It's part of the description. You just click that link, download it. It's a zip file. So don't be alarmed of, oh, I didn't, you know, you got to unzip it. There's some technical know-how,
right.
But it's not too difficult, hopefully. So yeah, follow us that way. And, you know, if you want to support these individual fine folks, Zach, where can you be found at?
You guys can find me on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube now as well, at that Zach Wilson. Trying to reach a goal of, I'm talking about mostly television, some movies on my YouTube channel. I'm trying to reach 1,000 subscribers by the end of the year. So help me on that challenge, that Zach Wilson.
Let's make that happen faster. I think we can make it happen faster, Zach.
Absolutely. You know what? It's great. Zach, welcome back. I haven't done a movie with Zach, and I love this interaction now of the booth. The booth aspect. I love this because before he was either in a completely, he's in such an opposite room, or we would only see the person way back when through a tiny window. So it's good to see you, Zach.
Sounds like you're giving, with this music, it sounds like you're giving a stump speech.
Well, I hope not, but you can follow me or please support me at DMovies1701. You can find me there on Twitter and say hi. And if you follow me, I 9 out of 10, I usually just follow you back.
That's right.
Because you were kind enough.
This music, I love it. So much energy. Go ahead, Marissa.
You can follow me on Twitter at SarahFiniTV.
And follow us here at The Popcorn Talk, at Movie Anatomy, and all these various different places. And we'll be back for more Anatomy of a Movie. The next one we're doing is Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And next week we're doing Deadpool and Zoolander 2. And oh my god, this music is so fast. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.